good afternoon, you saddle sniffers. It's your favorite industry hard bod with a brain, Ronnie Romance here. And yes, blondes do have more fun. I'm reporting to you live here today from Hadleyme, Connecticut, the most beautiful town you've ever flown over, to talk to you about ride quality and the qualities of those ride qualities. And here's the catch. It's not in the frame. The frame has absolutely, nearly, almost nothing to do with it.
What?
In today's video lesson, we're going to go over a few of my bikes and all of their contact points and what is making them comfortable contact points and what you should consider. And upgrades to your bike kind of links into a few of my other videos if you want to check out how I build my bikes or considerations. I think that's right here. I'll link to it. We're going to get right into this. What makes a bike ride well, essentially? Okay, what makes a bike ride well? If you want to talk about frame materials here first, folks, you know, beware of those sweeping proclamations that steel is most compliant, most comfortable, carbon, aluminum are stiff. Like, it's a lot more than just the material. Steel is actually the least compliant of all of the materials.
What?
Tricky to digest, but if you want to talk about deflection or modulus is how they measure how elastic a material is, steel has the highest modulus. Titanium has half the modulus of steel, basically half the stiffness of steel, while aluminum, believe it or not, is a third the stiffness of steel. Now, the way you make up for this is steel, you've noticed that steel tubes on bikes are the skinniest, right? That's the skinniest tube. You're able to use a very skinny tube and get the same amount of, substantial amount of stiffness with steel. Whereas titanium, you've probably noticed a lot of the titanium forks out there on the market, most recently with Bear Claw and Moots using that Bear Claw fork. But you'll notice that the tubes on these titanium forks, the fork blades are very oversized compared to like a steel fork. That is because you need to make the tube oversized in order for it to be stiff enough. Now, aluminum, you'll notice aluminum, well, here's an aluminum bike with an oversized down tube right here. Aluminum this is 7000 series aluminum and has a very thin tube, but it's oversized, and so you're getting that stiffness. Am I making any sense here? This is ridiculous.
Okay, bear with me, class. Let's try this.
When it comes to the double diamond frame design, triangle, both, you see, double diamond, two triangles. A triangle, by definition, is immovable. It's stiff. There is no vertical compliance, no matter what the material. None whatsoever. If it's a triangle, it will not flex. No way. Come at me in the comments if you have some sacred geometry of a triangle that flexes that we can apply to frame design. I'd be very interested. Steel is the stiffest material out there. You would never call it the stiffest material on a bicycle because it's all about how you tune the tubes.
Although you might as well just use straight gauge because, as we've already learned, vertical compliance is not gained by changing the material nor by butting the tubes. Butting the tubes will come in handy when saving weight or when tuning torsional stiffness. What it takes for your wheels to change axis is when force is applied. You feel this on a bicycle when you're accelerating, descending on rough stuff.
So you can feel the torsional stiffness difference in a frame. Now, the down tube is where the torsional stiffness comes into play. And when you describe a bike as noodly, that's generally because the down tube was undersized for your weight or riding style.
You ever been in a super low gear in your granny gear on a steel bike climbing up, especially loaded, climbing up a steep climb, and you could feel the bottom bracket kind of moving back and forth? That can be kind of annoying with some lighter tubing steel bikes, but it's fun on an aluminum bike when you compare it. Not necessarily better, it's just a different sensation to have it be like completely solid.
When it comes to tuning your down tubes, you know, you can either go flexi, where you're getting that planing effect.
What is planing, might you ask? It's you're putting energy into the bike. It's going away for a split second, and then it's coming back to you at the top of your pedal stroke, generally at the dead spot of your pedal stroke. So you're kind of, but it takes rhythm. You got to work with it. Now, in my opinion, any bicycle with good tires, inflated to the proper PSI, tuned tire, okay, you're going to get that planing action. That is, unless your tire is, you know, 28C or below, then it's more of the tubing. But anything above that, really, you're feeling the tires.
Which is desirable. I you know, if you know how to tame the bike and time your
pedal strokes,
you can actually, you know, get move with the bike with that down tube, kind of letting the bottom bracket sway back and forth. I like all bikes of all tubing, and I like to own them all and ride them all and feel the differences, because it is exhilarating. It gets me excited to go on bike rides when I'm not feeling motivated in particular.
Now for hardcore descending at speed with some technical attributes thrown in the mix. An undersized down tube, you know, especially when you need to change direction quickly, put on the brakes, you know, surging the brakes, you know, all of the bells and whistles you need to pull and whistle when you are hitting that rough stuff. That undersized down tube could be a handful. It can be tamed. Don't get me wrong. It can be tamed, but you know, generally, a little more torsional stiffness in that kind of situation will give you a little more confidence.
For just riding along, though, I think they feel great. So finding a happy medium. You know, too much torsional stiffness down there, the bike may bounce a little bit when you're trying to hold your line. Maybe not track the way that you really want it. But I feel that is less of a factor, as we'll talk about here later. There are much larger factors when it comes to how your bike handles and rides and feels. So open up your syllabus. We got some chapters to read here. Let me just look at my notes. Oh, okay, folks. The first most important component of your bicycle is the tires. You've heard me say it before. I am selling you tires, but I also mean it. Okay? Think of these things as a big old air spring. Okay? It's a low-tech solution that pretty much everyone's on board with. You got anyone riding solid rubber tires that you know of? Didn't think so. Okay, so the air spring that you got in these tires, matched with a lightweight casing and tubeless technology set at a low tire pressure, you've got a tuned air spring at that point. Too high a tire pressure, you tend to bounce along a little bit, a little too much rebound, you know what I'm saying? The basketball effect that you get on if you've ever ridden an overinflated fat bike, especially. Once you've tuned a tire like this in, I mean, really tweak those dials. Running this at, you know, 20 PSI, it's a 27.5 by 2.2, I'm getting a lot of traction and a lot of spring out of this system right here. Okay, so that is the biggest thing you could do for your ride quality. And you're seeing this in road cycling, you're seeing this in mountain biking, you're seeing this in cyclocross, seeing it in gravel, of course, across the board. Bigger tire, lower air pressure equals more comfortable bike. That's the number one thing you could do to make your bike ride better. All right, so light tire, I say a flexible casing, lighter weight, heavier tire, stiffer casing, and stiffness of the casing, big difference. Let's see what happens here. So you see, a heavier casing tire just kind of holds itself up, while a lighter casing just kind of folds into a neat little bundle of high TPI majesty. That's how they're gonna ride in comparison to one another, honestly. Now, two tires, two completely different applications. Whereas these tires do come in casings that are as thick as this, You got a lot more protection here, but it's also going to be a little bit stiffer, harsher of a ride. Whereas this, you're taking some more risks. Whereas when it comes to pinch flats or sidewall tears, but just choose your line appropriately, and you too can ride a nice light tire. Way fewer pinch flats, way fewer sidewall slices with a tire like this. You're going to have to steer around obstacles with this one, whereas you could roll over obstacles with this one. And if you live in a place that has a lot of sharp rocks and other things, and you tend to be just somebody who gets a lot of flat tires, then, you could work your way up to this.
If you are a serial flatter, then not flatting should be your priority over ride quality. Sorry.
Okay, second most important contact point on your bike is the contact point of them all, your saddle. How's that thing going to interact with your taint and vice versa? I prefer the hammock style leather saddles, as they do have some more vertical compliance, deflection if you will, than a hard shelled plastic with foam on top. It's a little bit more natural of a feeling to me. I've tried a lot of saddles over the years. I've had urethral problems stemming back to when I was 13 years old. I've had 3 urethral stricture surgeries, and I've settled on the hammock style saddle to interface best with my undercarriage. Everybody's undercarriages are different, but I could say that I've had a very tortured undercarriage for many, many decades, and I've tried everything. These are what work best for me. Now, titanium rails. Titanium, as we said, is a very compliant material. You know, with a small diameter, it's going to have a lot of deflection to it. I found that the super expensive titanium railed saddles do ride better. They are actually not only lighter but more comfortable also. Now, the softer the leather is, the more broken in it is. That's also going to be a factor in the ride quality. As you can see, this saddle in particular, it's very soft. I've had this one for a few years and it's pretty well broken in. This one right here is newer. It's a Sella Ideale saddle, and I've got about 350 miles in on this one so far. It's a stiffer leather. It's going to take longer to break in, but the plus side is it's going to last a lot longer if your taint can handle it. That's the thing. You know, sometimes if a saddle breaks in too easily in the beginning, then it's mainly last 1 or 2 years. Obviously you adjust the little nut on the end here, and that either stretches it out or relaxes it a bit. And you don't ever ride these in the rain. That'll ruin your saddle. That'll make it wear out
years too early.
Put a plastic bag over that thing if it's going to be raining and you're going to be riding on it. Don't get those things wet. Easier than you think, honestly. Next we'd have to touch on the seat post. Seat post here, class. Now the seat post, now you've got a cantilever here, as you see. It's not braced by anything. You are going to get compliance out of that, okay? There's no triangle here to hold it in either direction. So a seat post like this is, a bit oversized. And there's not much post showing here, so I'm not getting a huge cantilever effect. So a lot of my comfort in this rear end here is coming from this bigger tire and this saddle being super well broken in and nice and soft. Not getting much from the seat post here. Now on this bike, you'll notice that we've got a smaller diameter seat post made out of titanium. It's a little bit longer. We are getting a little bit of vertical deflection here, okay? It is perceivable, so. More and more, I've been moving to the more seat post look. I think it looks great with a straight blade fork. It's got a racier look, certainly. But I'd like to take advantage of that deflection. Why not? Charlie Cunningham did it way back when. So it could be considered classic, so to speak. Your more compact frame design like this. More seat post. I think there's something to it. What we're talking about next here is handlebars. Let's talk about handlebars. Obviously, whether you select a drop bar setup or an upright bar setup is going to have a huge impact on how that bicycle rides. I like having both. I like having an upright drop bar bike, a low-down drop bar bike, an upright bike that's made for performance, an upright bike that's just made for cruising. These two right here, this is my performance drop bar bike and my performance upright bike. So I thought those would be the best examples. I'm getting some deflection out of these handlebars on this bike for sure. I like these swept back handlebars. These are made out of aluminum, but look at this. Look at how much suspension I'm getting out of these handlebars. Okay? That's quite a bit of deflection. That's going to make your bike ride more comfortably. So that's why I like upright handlebars for ATB riding and my type of mountain biking, which is the kind of riding I tend to do more often than not. With a drop bar, let's see, are we getting some deflection here? I'd say we are. I could see it in the fork too, though. See a lot in the fork, actually. Really, when 31.8 came around, which is basically the industry standard right now, things were just fine with 26 and 25.4. Really, the 31.8 was one of the first wholesale cash-ins on the industry of changing a standard. You know, one benefit of an oversized handlebar clamp would be that there's more clampable area if you tend to slip your handlebars quite a bit, but that's really the only advantage, you know. I think it makes sense for modern carbon fiber handlebars where they want to shape the tops and make them, you know, all these strange, weird shapes that don't look like bicycle shapes. But, you know, that's an advantage. But we're not talking about that with these types of bikes, are we? You know, 26.0, we do 26.0 for everything. And that works. That's a standard. That's a long-lasting standard. You will get some more vertical compliance there with a standard size 26.0, 25.4 handlebar. You know, really, that oversized handlebar is just a gimmick that everyone bought in on. And on this bike right here, we've got a 25.4 mountain bike stem with a 26.0 handlebar. They work great together. You just got to pry open the faceplate a little bit with a screwdriver when you're putting these handlebars in and just tighten them as you would normally, and everything just kind of matches up and works just fine. The only downside is there's no downside. The plus side is that a 25.4 clamp is less likely to slip with a 26.0 handlebar. I've never slipped these or any of these other setups that I've been using for years with a 25.4 stem clamp and a 26.0 handlebar. So, you know, don't confuse yourself with these different standards. Obviously, you can't use a 26.0 handlebar clamp with a 25.4 handlebar without shims, and I find those shims always slip no matter what, so don't ever try that. But absolutely try a 25.4 stem with a 26.0 handlebar. Tell me about it in the comments if you've ever had one break and you're missing a bunch of teeth and I should watch out, because my face is my livelihood. Okay, yeah, let's talk about forks. A few different fork types we'll go over. Yeah, I kind of followed industry trends till about 2000. Yeah, till the summer of 2001. I was all tech all the time. 2001, I was into free ride hardtails. We didn't have North Shore in the Northeast, but we tried to make it as North Shore as possible. And I ended up getting my arm twisted in a tree on a sweet wheelie drop. It was like 4 feet. And after that, I swore off suspension. And I've ridden it a few times since then, but I've never owned a suspension bike since 2001. Suspension forks, for whatever reason, there's trauma associated with suspension forks or something. I don't know. It's just a matter of me feeling like I'm going faster than I'm comfortable going. So, rigid forks. Been riding rigid since 2001. Got three different fork styles here. Your straight blade.
So, oh yeah, Ernesto Colnago invented the straight blade fork in the late 80s, and it was said to improve shock absorption from the ground up. Now, is that marketing? No one really knows, but straight blade forks look great with a sloping top tube, in my opinion. And they just look racier. I suppose there's less tubing because you don't need to have that little bend at the bottom that takes a little extra tubing. So you're probably saving about 20 grams right there. That's like two pencils, right?
Curved blade steel fork. And you've got your curved blade carbon fibre fork. Where does the deflection in a fork come from? I mean, a lot of people will see this curve right here and be, and I, you know, I'm willing to bet that, you know, you're going to get a little bit of deflection here. Going to get some vibration dampening, certainly. But as it works, you know, the main stress riser of the fork is in the crown. The cantilever is long. You know, you've got a lot of leverage. A lot of leverage right here pulling back. And it's not going to be taken up right here. It's, you know, it's going to be at the, you know, at the beginning of the lever. There's, you know, there's not much force being put on this lever as opposed to this lever when taking into consideration your frontwards hits like this. You know, it's really my opinion, and I'm sure a few others. I'd love to know your opinion, where the deflection on a fork is coming from. I'm just always thinking about it. I don't think there are any real tests out there to back any of this up, so I'm just speculating, but I find that a straight blade fork rides no better or worse than a fork with some skinny bend in the bottom. So I'd love to know your opinion.
But what about telescopic forces?
We're going to do a little compliance test and a scientific application process of running tape from the axle. Oops. We're going to run tape from the axle to get it fairly taut. So, a drum roll. I see it moving now.
Oh, yeah!
So, we are getting... So, as the scientific method has shown us, there is telescopic compliance in a curved blade fork. We are unable to measure the telescopic compliance of a straight blade fork because the two axes... I just can't attach tape on a... You know, there's no place to attach the tape.
And then you've got a carbon fork. So if we're talking about most of the deflection in your fork coming from the end of the lever up here, then this carbon fork would have next to no flex. And I know a lot of them are designed like this, ovalized to being heavily reinforced in the back. This is a lightweight fork, probably weighs half as much as a steel fork. They've really got to make these things stiff by shape, you know. Otherwise, you're really risking some sort of stress fracture or a crack up here at the stress riser. You know, that's a risk. That's a big risk because when your fork goes, you know, everything else follows. So when it comes to compliance in your fork, I don't think carbon is the best material. I think it needs to be built too rigid at the top in order to accommodate the stresses that it receives up here. And I think steel forks ride really nice. Both of these forks would ride great, and they do ride great. It's just a matter of aesthetics at this point. I like the straight blade. If I'm using a sloping top tube with a little bit more post, I think the straight blade is the way to go. I think it looks really nice. Level top tube, I'm using a fork like this. Not using a fork like this on anything. I think that there's an anemic amount of steel fork, high-end steel fork options out there on the market today. So I hope they start making a comeback. Geometry being another major consideration, major to minor. Like I said, you do get used to a lot of different geometries when it comes to just everyday riding. But when you get into the extremes, you know, when you want to push your bike a little bit further, that's when geometry starts really playing into the ride quality of your bicycle. Now, picture a bigger offset, a higher trail, so to speak, a longer front end to your bike. This is indicative of, downhill, free ride, more modern mountain bike geometry. Picture a long front end. When you're moving quickly, moving backwards, when you're moving quickly, it tracks, it's nice and stable, okay? But when you're moving slower, you're gonna feel that you're fighting. It wants to tip. I call that wheel flop. Say you're descending down something steep, a long front end, you're gonna have a lot more control because you're behind the front axis. Now let's talk about a steep head tube angle or low trail. You're grabbing right here. So picture my body as the head tube, essentially. Minimal to no wheel flop. But if I were to be sending it down a rough single track or a steep Jeep road, I hit a bump, I'm going right over and landing inside the wheelbarrow, like this. Unless you're doing the extremes, really, both of these are gonna feel fine to you. You spend enough time on a bicycle, for me it's 10, 15 minutes and all bikes feel the same, honestly. As far as geometry goes, low trail, medium trail, low trail, no trail. Probably not no trail, but you know what I mean. What else can I do with this wheelbarrow? Hopefully that analogy, that scientific analogy, worked for you. I don't know if it did. You're like, so this is higher education, huh? This is what I'm sending my kids to college for. Huh? To get explained geometry by a barefoot guy pushing a wheelbarrow. These three bikes all generally have different geometries. You have a much more relaxed Rivendell geometry on here, where your general Rivendell geometry here, your slacker C tube angle is going to have you just kind of sitting back into the bike. It's more of a comfortable riding position when you're not on the rivets, so to speak. On the rivets, of course, meaning on the nose of the saddle, sitting on your rivets. It's an old racing term. That means when you're really putting power into the pedals, trying to win major races and events, as one often does, trying to win gravel grinders. And in that case, a steeper C-tube angle is advantageous to that type of riding. Then my all-around bike, my trusty Alumilith here, has slacker mountain bike geometry. It's got pretty neutral C-tube angle here. Everything's pretty basic here. Now you can see my setup for the upright handlebars. I'm leaning into them. They're set up a little bit lower than my saddle, so I've got some weight on the front tire there. You'll see that it's essentially like when I'm descending or dropping down something really steep. You see how far back my hands can go here. I could get so much weight back behind the wheel here, or I could scoot my hands forward when I'm climbing and get a little bit more weight forward. So it's a nice position for all-around off-road riding, in my opinion. Different uses. It's just all about your different uses. And the more you get into bikes, the more you are looking for things that are a little bit, you know, on the fringes there. You want to test and see how different things feel and work. I encourage all of that because, I love company. Well, that's pretty much it there, folks. Yeah, I hope you get a better understanding as to where to upgrade your bicycle to make it a nicer ride for you. And, I encourage tinkering around with all this stuff. I believe it makes you a more well-rounded cyclist to know the ins and outs of what makes this stuff tick, because it's pretty cool with the analog bike like what we have. Yeah, so, let me know how you like this video down in the comments. Make sure you subscribe, like, subscribe, subscribe, like. Wait 10 minutes, like again. Tell your mom, get her to like it and subscribe. Unsubscribe and then like and subscribe again. And, maybe then I'll keep doing this kind of stuff. So, all right, as always, this has been brought to you by ronsbikes.com and ultradynamico.com, the dynamic choice in high-end rubber. Thank you. And wow, it is beautiful out here right now. I'm going to go for a bike ride because I get all jazzed up talking about this stuff. I'm just fluffed. I'm all fluffed up talking about this stuff, you know? So I'm going to go for a bike ride and let it out, you know? Oof. Holy shit, those pins hurt. RonSpikes.com. RonSpikes.com.